Welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, the Maine Audio Information and Reading Service, a program of the IRIS Network, serving Maine's blind and visually impaired. My name is Cynthia Bowman, and I'm reading The Log of the Skipper's Wife. This is the diary of Dorothea Moulton Bellano, edited by her son, James W. Bellano. Our last episode revealed Dorothea having mother-in-law troubles. Having arrived in Boston, the young woman looked forward to and enjoyed much that was on offer. Theater, opera, cafes. But Fred's mother is a complainer. She left Port Clyde and took the steamer from Bangor in order to spend time with her son and his wife in Boston. Nothing is right for Mother B. Dorothea plies her with sweets to counter the sour disposition, and after two glasses of wine, the older woman returns to the ship, grinning. We're in the middle of Dorothea's account of April 10th, 1912. She's still thinking of her baby, as well as her mother-in-law. We'll continue reading. I need calmness for my child to be born in good shape, and there's no chance for that with Mother B about. God knows she's a good woman, and I don't want to get to hate her, so the best thing to do is to avoid her. You don't do that by taking her into account, not even when she's sitting beside you at the theater, jawing away. I made the mistake of telling her at intermission about the research I'd done on her ancestors. What did you want to do that for? It's interesting. Where they come from don't bother me none, she said. Reminds me of the story they tell about her back in Port Clyde, the one of her and the parson who came to call on Sunday and sat with her in the parlor, open that day only. Says the parson, distraught with the heavy silence. Nice sheep you got out in the yard, Mrs. Bellano, says she. They look all right on this side. Careful Carolyn, she's called, hanging on to not every penny, but every word as well. If that's how to accumulate money, I'll settle for a garret in Paris with hard cheese and watered absinthe. And worst of it is that when she's around Fred, he is Mama's dutiful little boy, yessing her to kingdom come and siding with her against my jest and youthful jollity. Nothing I do or say is acceptable to their conspiracy to beat me down to their penny-pinching show. Yet when either of them wants something, I'm the one to go running. And whatever I do is either wrong or odd or queer. All the thanks I got for making tea was that it was too weak for him and too strong for her. To hell with both of them. I'll see every show in town while they stare at each other and count their shares in vessels. That way someone will get some use out of the filthy lucre they've saved by giving messenger boys rotten apples and sailors wormy biscuits. April 14th, 1912. Yesterday at matinee to see Donald Bryan in The Siren, written by the author of The Dollar Princess. It has a company of 100. The scene is laid in fabulous Venice. Has a very slight but intriguing plot, which holds together some poems of love written to the queen, whose king finally discovers them and recognizes the author, who is banished but later forgiven and allowed to wed Lolette, whom he was after all along, but used the stratagem to startle the lethargic king, or duke, into giving Lolotte her freedom by showing that the queen was more suitable to him than Lolotte. The show had a very striking waltz, the Valse Caprice, sung ecstatically by Bryan and Miss Julia Sanderson. Also a two-step, sung by two minor actors. Oh, do step the two-step, so light and catchy. Gay songs with the chorus dancing and, in the opening scene, I always come back to you. A fat couple furnish the comic element, he a veterinary surgeon, and poor Lolotte calls him a horse doctor, while he sings, pathetically off-key, I want to sing in opera. After the show, I ran into Miss Henderson, and we sipped a glass of inspiring Madeira while I acceded to her desire to learn about the sea by teaching her the rules of the road in Dossie's verse. When on to starboard, red is seen, well on to bow, before to beam, port beware, reduce to speed. The red light had to right of way, to law command, you must obey, and green to green, red to red, perfect safety, go ahead. Husband says, no new boots for me. You just watch me get them. Will he ever go ashore with me? Is he ashamed to be his usual generous self when his mother is watching? I am beginning to believe that his natural generosity is controverted by memories of the training she gave him. Captain J.W., being a generous person, should never have left Fred at home as a boy to assimilate her penuriousness. Captain Will has spent wisely and well over her opposition at every step, otherwise the family would not own the waterworks supplying the village or the tenements built of old dunnage, or the many income-producing investments in assets other than the old hulks, onto which the huppers hang when everyone with half an eye can see that sailing vessels are doomed and steamers are the future. Captain Will has shares in many a steamer, although he loves sail, but the huppers can't see beyond the bowsprit of a three-master. She nearly climbed the spanker when she heard that her husband had put $1,000 into Sosthene Bain's newfangled Puerto Rican telephone company. It's now paying well and doubling value every few months, but she just knows it is money poured overboard. Oh, well, I shall stay in my cabin with my diary and read the new Saturday Evening Post for mirth and the Outlook for catching up on the world. Ought to write some letters, but don't want my mother-in-law's jaundice to seep into them. April 18, 1912. Towed over to the molasses dock to load shooks. Editor's note, shooks are unassembled barrels or hogsheads. 4 first-class battleships at Boston Navy Yard, the biggest dry dock on the coast. Also a cruiser and some cutters. With the manner in which Kaiser Bill is acting now that he has fired Bismarck, we shall need a fleet. The foolish boy was controlled by his great statesman until recently, but now he is madly interfering in Morocco after his shameful backing down in the South Seas when the English backed the Americans against the German fleet. If there's trouble and war, I doubt Fred will be prepared. All he thinks of when I say we must prepare is that the authorities in Washington may not let the old steward go to sea with us. That's international awareness. Such a terrible maritime disaster last Monday evening. The Titanic of the White Star Line, largest steamer afloat, struck an iceberg off Newfoundland on her maiden trip to New York. Only about 1/3 of the crew and passengers saved. The rest drowned with the ship. Everyone is much astir over the news. Fred said, that's what they get for building them with all top and no bottom. Glorious day! Mother B. sailed home. Father B. arrove in Baltimore Tuesday, and we tried to get her to go on and visit him. I've served my time, she said, and my home suits me fine. She made some remark about the stewardess he has on board, and I suppose the poor old gent just has to find consolation somewhere. She did not thank Fred for the lovely amber beads we gave her, nor did she kiss him goodbye when she was hoisted up the gangway on the Bangor boat. It's eerily unnatural, and I, who am supposed to live with her during my pre-hospital pregnancy and until I can furnish the lovely little house I've chosen for my own, shall have to be wary that her spleen does not enter my unborn baby's milk. 'Twas the 18th of April in 75, and hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year. But Mother B is gone, she took a dive, and Fred has become a perfect dear. Wouldn't you know it, Dora's a poet. Wrote some letters in that mood, and all my friends won't know the woes I've suffered, praise the Lord. We may get away Saturday to see. If not, we may go to New York and spend the day with Father B., which would be great. I wrote him yesterday that I'd love to see him. Fred took a goodly share in Crowell and Thurlow's new steamer. That's progress. His mother would have told him to keep it in the bank. I told him to take it out. The poor darling is caught between Hupper hoarding and Moulton munificence. But Captain J.W. will be glad to hear that Fred has slipped moorings from his mother's backwardness. Captain Kent is to be master of the new steamer, and has asked Fred to come with him, so as to prepare for being master of the next steamer. She's to be completed early next year. Had my classmates, who are now studying at Radcliffe, Francis and Marion, on board for tea, and those sweet but very practical girls asked me to stop wasting my time on my diary and write a book about my travels. From the poetry I write, I guess I'd better not. I'm too prone to write what the publishers would never print. Had my Rio photos framed, and shall take one on board for hanging in the cabin. The rest are bound for my hideaway in Herring Gut, to devour while I'm home and Fred is abroad. Tuesday evening heard the New York Metropolitan Opera Company do Königskinder, first time ever played here. Geraldine Farrar made the Goose Girls strong and sweet at the same time. Slender, blonde, and beautiful, she hails from Melrose. Carl Jorn is wonderful as the king's son, but Goritz, the itinerant fiddler, showed more power in his voice and more promise than any of the others. The large and splendidly conducted orchestra was strong both in crescendo and retard. There were many motifs and several catchy peasant songs in this fairy opera so typically German with Schmaltz. How can such a sentimental people fight so much? Humperdinck took 3 years to write the opera. To say I enjoyed every minute of the long opera would be putting it mildly. Aside from the beautiful music and lines and costumes, I enjoyed the escape from Mother B. and the rest of the world's sordidness as a little Dora, age 9. Some might say that's unrealistic, but I find it very healthy to participate in God-given reliefs from baseness, if for no other reason than to be fortified in facing them. So, my dear children and grandchildren, at the risk of boring you blue, I give you the story of the opera, which reinforced me so that I might make myself strong enough to give you not only birth, but also brightness. The Goose Girl, of royal parentage, has been reared by the witch in poverty. The king's son woos her, but can't beat the spell cast by the witch. She cannot break away from the witch, although she loves the prince. The fiddler and his merry companions come to inquire of her who should be their ruler. He it is who urges the Goose Girl to cast off the spell and go to the prince with his crown on her head, the fiddler having preempted the crown for her to wear. In a trance, she answers that the next person who enters the city's gates shall be the next ruler. The second act is very different from the first. It is set in a village where many people are dancing, and Jorn is at his best. Among the throng is the stout, jolly innkeeper, and many royal counselors and courtiers. The prince, unrecognized, is bewailing his sad state, but decides to establish his kingly prerogatives and assume the crown. The fiddler brings to him the beautiful Goose Girl. A little peasant child is the only one who, enchanted, sees in the prince and the Goose Girl the real, good, and lawful rulers. The king's son and the Goose Girl depart together. The third act is sad. The witch has died. The fiddler lives solemnly in a hut. The king and queen, wandering hungrily about the country, despised, trade their crowns for a loaf of bread, and forthwith die, lovely, Geraldine sings, Ich liebe dich. Perfect schmaltz, and I drank in every sentimental note, so thirsty was I for something better than salt beef, crudities, and Mother B's ungraciousness. Went out and got tickets for Lohengrin, as I intend to stay on this drunk until we sail. April 25th, 1912, bound for Puerto Rico, fair and strong southwest winds. Miss Henderson, seasick, and I sewing on Fred's blue shirt while sitting in my deck chair atop the house, where it is very pleasant watching the ships pass us on their way to Boston. Only one new man in the crew, the mate. Fred claims this is because the Hopkins is known as a lucky vessel, and also one of the few on which the skipper provides fresh fruits and vegetables. The rest, methinks, must be pretty bad. The steamers, with their refrigerated compartments for food, must be better. Today passed a beautiful bark, and my heart is torn between the beauty of sail and the bounty of steam. How I do love sail, the white of the canvas against the yellow pine masts, all lighted by the sun over a sparkling blue sea, a glorious symphony of color. April 28, 1912, 67 west longitude, 36 north latitude. Full moon, calm, horrors. In the midst of our jubilation about having a quick good run comes this full moon calm. Here we are, south of Bermuda, in no time at all, with only 10 degrees to make for southing, and no northeast trades to keep us from drifting eastward. After a very calm 24 hours, however, a slight breeze sprang up from the southwest, and so we celebrated with canned asparagus, most savory. Reminded me of our visit with Father B, who said, contrasting modern conveniences on shipboard with those of a generation ago, "Nowadays I don't ship a cook so much as a can opener." He once served as cook on a fishing schooner and spent 20 hours a day keeping the fishermen stuffed. To this day he is a remarkably fine cook and epicure who loves good food, well prepared. I love him. He has nothing tawdry or shoddy about him, but can be wholesomely bawdy. At 58 he has not one cavity in his beautiful teeth, stands his own watch at sea, even though he can afford several mates. He loves to handle the ship himself, or else he'd be ashore managing the fleet. He'd better, soon, or the clerks, under Mother B's parsimonious hands, will so stint on repairs and maintenance that there'll be no fleet. Miss Henderson is sunning herself on deck between hard swallows and trips, now less frequent, to the rail. Dawsey explained why she should go to leeward for that. He calls it lured, and she told me she thought he said lewd. It didn't make sense to her, she said, but neither does anything else right now. The poor Boston Herald is not getting much out of her. She sighted a cockroach in her stateroom, filled it with roach powder, climbed into my hammock on deck, and the swaying of it made her sicker than ever. Fred said the cockroaches love the powder, and sure enough there were several more this morning when the steward cleaned her room. The poor child... Fred told her not to kill Herman, the ship's mascot cockroach, and she fairly shriveled. Made a little slip for baby's wardrobe, with the little strength remaining in me from my trying to contain my cruel laughter at Miss Henderson's tribulations. Haven't much strength anyway, what with the baby taking it all. But what care I, so long as it is a good, healthy, and bright little baby, with a nose like its papa's. For the 10th time, Dora writes some letters. May 2nd, 1912. 400 miles to go to Humacao, according to my sights. 401, according to my conservative down east spouse. Does my sextant cheat to give me the impression we're doing better than we are? Fred doesn't like Humacao, wants to go to Aguirre. Humacao is too shoal, he says, and too far east. He doesn't want to have to spend several days beating to windward, nor do I. Have washed and ironed for 3 days straight, and tomorrow is Friday with some little garments unironed. Why can't people go naked? Am enjoying respites from ironing by doing my baby's layette, little checkered dimity dress today, a princess type, which I hope I shall turn into a prince type. But it's easier to trim off lace than to tack it on if he is a girl. Put down new linoleum on dining saloon deck, a great improvement. Also salved Miss Henderson's sunburn. She's beet red and blistered, and I don't see how she can be enjoying her trip, but she says she is. I hope so, because she's taking such an interest in Baby B, and is such a dear person. Hot. I have no more appetite, for once, than a rock and twice as much gas as Vesuvius. Mother never told me about this part of pregnancy. Fred flirting with Miss Henderson, the old goat, but she's too sunburned to reciprocate, thank God. I don't want to laugh at him, but I can't help it. He's so obvious and so left-footed. To flatter her, he said she looked like a boiled lobster. May 3rd, 1912. 61, 52 longitude, says Fred, and I say 62, 01, with just 300 miles more southing to make, and 180 miles to beat to the westward if the trade winds, upon which we based our hopes, do not materialize. We had assumed they would head us off about here, and so we slanted east to take advantage of the good westerly breezes, to put us into the northeast trades. If they don't come, we'll make a slow passage, beating west, damn it. Time to whistle for wind, since we have no more old shoes to sacrifice. Fred is charming now that baby is a fait accompli. Says if it's a girl, we shall name it for me. If it's a boy, for him or his father, James Wilfred. I think Fred Moulton Bellano would be a lovely name. I told him that, for economy's sake, I'd like twins and save going through this ordeal again. One boy and one girl would make everyone satisfied. Speaking of being satisfied, I forgot to tell you, diary, about the little Shaw boy in Rio and the bonde he takes to school. It seems one mealtime he told his mother he was full, in Portuguese. In that tongue it's more polite to say, my appetite is satisfied. The next day he was late from school, and gave as an excuse that o bonde estava satisfito, the tram was satisfied, too full. Sunday, May 5th, 1912. 13 days out from Boston, and anxious to get in. Wonder if Captain Krieger has arrived. He ought to have, because he sailed 2 days before we did. His lovely wife, Jenny Flood Krieger, is to have a vessel named for her, and Captain Billy will sail her. That's one launching I won't miss. She is such a determined down-easter, the best, that I can imagine her chasing the vessel down the ways with the champagne bottle and swimming out to christen her, saying a ship should only be christened when afloat. The old steward just came aft with a tiny black derby on his spreading white locks, looking like a late edition of Puck, and said I was to tell that domned Fred that the baby would need a nurse, and that he, the old steward, knew all about nursing from having been Fred's. I think I make a better job dis next time. Miss Henderson taught me a new fudge recipe, using Cairo syrup instead of water. It's chewier than the other and not so sickeningly sweet. Made some for a trial run, and Fred said it weren't bad, just a mite sour. If he doesn't end up with sugar diabetes, I'll never know why. So far, baby's outfit has cost the whole sum of $10. Nightgowns, flannels, diaper cloth. It will need another $10 and 5 more for mine. Took some medicine yesterday and feel better today. Finished reading Recording Angel in the Post by Mrs. C. L. Harris, who does a good job with style on characters of ordinary interest. They come alive, even the humdrum ones. Like, I wish my diary would come alive with such mundane entries as washing, ironing, and asparagus. I'm sure my children will never get beyond page 1 in this diary of mine, but I really don't care, because it has served me well to record my thoughts, my spites, and some things to look back on, such as au mieux, rio, amor, mieux. May 7th, 1912. Sighted St. Thomas's Hills and Culebra. Have a whole day's sail before us unless we get more wind. Do those who marry in their teens find their duties of married life easier? I wouldn't be surprised if they do. I find my education getting in the way of giving in to my husband's selfish lust, and blame myself for not being more amenable to the Julie O'Grady mentality. Kipling was off course when he said she and the colonel's lady were sisters under the skin. That was male wishful thinking, ruddy rudy and rudely put. Sunday morning, May 12, 1912. Still not a whisper of a breeze, but Fred enjoying the fishing. Caught several barracudas, and they're as tasty as they are ugly. Lowered the launch and towed the vessel several miles, trying to make the entrance to Maranaibo port. Anchored off Yabacau. The number of Portuguese names ending in A-O assure me that many of the influential men in the Spanish discovery ships were Portuguese. Yet the Galegos from Galicia speak Spanish with a heavy Portuguese influence. They can hardly be understood by the Andalusians, who mimic them. Up sail and away this morning, but as Fred says so poetically, this wind ain't a good fart. Wrote to Mrs. Dara, poor dear, and Myra and Betty and Father B., while Fred fretted and fished. Still almost calm, and I suppose many people would enjoy being here below the lovely hills of El Yunque, the Anvil Mountain, with its rainforest, but not if they had a cargo awaiting. I hate doldrums. Fred had target practice with his rifle when the big shark surfaced. Got him, and shouted to him to go back and tell those who sent him that they'd get the same treatment if they held the wind back any longer. I hope Neptune won't be offended. I get all me, too. That's all we have time for in this edition of The Maine Reader. We're reading The Log of the Skipper's Wife, the diary of Dorothea Moulton Bellano, edited by her son, James. I'm Cynthia Bowman. Thank you for listening.